In terms of how sin affects us in the image of God, because I have deliberately avoided trying to be absolutely categorical about what being in the image of God exactly means, which is probably a bit controversial, and I'm still not 100% sure whether I am right to have done so, but it's where I'm sort of in a work in progress at the moment in my own mind, that actually, in a way, just as Christianity is not a philosophy but a person, so should we think of being in the image of God, not as a list of categories, but a person. I cannot reduce a person to any one or five things. There's an old proverb that says, when a man dies, a library is destroyed. If you think of what is in a library, I do quite a lot of work in the Balkans in former Yugoslavia, and I was in Sarajevo just a couple of weeks ago. It's one of my favorite cities on earth. It's the most affecting place. And one of there were some terrible things that happened during the siege of Sarajevo in the 90s. 3.5 years. Can you imagine? In the modern world, a siege. You know, you think of Middle Ages, but this was basically a siege that was sustained indirectly by the United Nations. I mean, anyway. But one of the things culturally that was most devastating is that there was a library that was built by the Austro-Hungarians, and it was a beautiful building, and it became, when Bosnia became independent from Yugoslavia, that became the Bosnian National Archive. And so it was a deliberate Serb target, and it was completely destroyed. Over 1 million books and countless papers, records, all about Bosnian identity, up in smoke in one night, never to be found again. But there's a sense in which just an individual life that happens. It's one of the reasons I think death is always a tragedy. Always. Death is always wrong. It's always wrong. Yeah, there are some mitigating circumstances. There's some, you know, it might be a merciful release. There might be some good that comes out of it. But the bottom line, it's always wrong. Jesus wept. It's always wrong. It's not how we're meant to be. So I'm not going to be sort of categorical about what the elements that make up being an image of God are, but let's assume that there are a number, and for the sake of argument, let's assume, I don't know, there are six, so that I can make a nice little sort of pie chart. There's our pie that we've got into segments, and you might want to put down things like sort of responsibility, creativity, intelligence, compassion, empathy, physicality, materiality, all kinds of itties and isms. Bung them on there. And those are the sort of baseline things that we are all made with, and they're the constituents, the components of being human. But the wonderful thing about human beings is that we're all different, isn't it? I mean, isn't that lovely? I just love the stimulus of being with people who think differently and are different and have different experience. And, you know, it can be threatening. But also, though, if there are sort of common ground and there are boundaries and so on, it can be wonderful and interesting. And, oh, you think like that? Gosh, I'd never thought of that. I mean, isn't that, I love that. But one of the ways in which we are all different is the fact that sin affects us all differently. And some people are, say, one element, one constituent part of being in the image of God is more affected than somebody else with that constituent part. So, for instance, some people, let's take a really crude illustration, some people are born with severe physical deformity. And it's remarkable when you meet people like that for whom it's just irrelevant. I mean, their lives, I mean, you've seen sort of things they go around on Facebook and stuff, don't they, of, you know, people playing guitar concertos with their toes. I mean, just blows you away. How do they do that? My toes are rubbish. Just amazing. Someone who had no hands, no arms, but could play the guitar with his feet or paint. The human capacity to overcome limitation is quite remarkable. I would call that a gift of common grace in many ways. But someone else is born with the most extraordinary physical attributes. You know, who's that swimmer, the American guy who just won everything at the Olympics? Phelps. His lung size is basically 1.5 times bigger the average of a normal male. So he was born with big lungs. That's, you know, that is what part of the secret of success. Now, obviously, he puts in hours of the most tedious. I mean, competitive swimming to me is the most boring. I can't imagine anything more tedious, both to watch and do. But, you know, wow. And I was reading an article about him that he may well be in line to win medals again at Rio. So that would be potentially the fourth Olympics at which he could win swimming gold. That would be unheard of. Nobody else has done that, but he could. Anyway, that's amazing. He has this sort of physical capacity. He was born with that. Now, I've got lungs, but they're not so good underwater in all kinds of ways. But you see what I mean. Now, let's suppose that all these different capacities, you know, it's sort of shared out differently and it outworked differently, both in terms of what is good and what is not so good and how sin affects us. So that you know, don't you, that the things that you are tempted by may be completely irrelevant to your neighbor. Which is something to bear in mind when we judge others, isn't it? We're very quick to forgive others who sin like us and very slow to forgive those who sin differently. Let's suppose then that it works a bit like this, that actually we are all marred in some shape or form, and it's as if you sort of make that a sort of 3D thing and build it up like a sort of a cone, that each has, you can see what it should have been, you could see what it could be, but it's somehow, one element is more affected or badly damaged than another. Do you see what I mean? But this is the bottom line. The image is still there. They're still the six segments. So even if, let's say, the capacity to process thought or the capacity to remember, well, it may be, say, through not so much individual sin as the fact of being in a fallen, broken world, I get Alzheimer's and I begin to lose my short and perhaps even long-term memory. And so, you know, the memory segment, if that is a segment, begins to sort of erode much more quickly. It's not that I've lost my humanness, but a significant element has been more corroded than others. But actually, someone who has that sort of mental corrosion may physically, in other ways, be doing really well. Their heart could be pumping, you know, with the energy of a man 20 years younger. Whereas somebody else, it could be the complete other way around. Do you see what I'm saying? So just because one element of our createdness is more visibly or obviously damaged or ruined by sin than another, that doesn't stop me being created in God's image. I'm still in his image. So Iris Murdoch watching Teletubbies is still in God's image, still has innate value, because there are plenty of other things about her, her capacity to love her husband sometimes. Remarkable. Where does that come from? What is that? Well, it's out of the image of God, but there are other parts, as her body began to fail and all kinds of other things going on. It's confusing. It's a mixture. But this is where the wonder of the gospel comes in, because you see, each of us has a different graph, if you like, from that. Depending on our age, our upbringing, our understanding, our culture, our discipleship, you name it. But when we come to Jesus, he's like that. Everything in its right place, integrated, whole, shalom, human. The image of God is all there, but it's perfected. It's full. It's everything we were meant to be. We don't see everything subject to him, but we do see Jesus, said Hebrews 2. He had to become human. not just so that we could see what being human was really all about, but so that we could become what being human is really all about. Now, I hope I haven't completely confused you. This is just a way I found helpful to get my head around some of this, but if that's confusing or you have another way of thinking about it, that would be helpful. But I thought I'd just throw that in and then see what happens. So let's see what happens. anything about that or other comments, questions? Yeah. So the question is, we're not fully human until we're in heaven. You see, absolutely. So we are fading. We are decomposing. That, you know, what is it? Your brain starts sort of losing cells at the age of 19 or 18 or 19. So basically, pretty much everyone in this room, is all downhill from now. And that's the way it is. We will die. Bits will fall off. We'll lose our mind. That's the reality. There was this amazing... I worked for a church in Oxford after leaving university, and she's no longer alive, but I was a baby Christian, really. I didn't understand anything. I look back at my student days as a Christian, and I just want to curl into a ball and say, don't look at me. But anyway, there we are. There was this amazing lady in the church called Pat, and I can't remember exactly what she had, but it was the most appalling bone disease. It wasn't brittle bone, but it was something like that. And basically, her entire skeleton was both seizing up and cracking apart. I mean, unbelievable. So she had this incredibly complicated and rather startling motorized wheelchair thing that, you know, it was quite terrifying if you encountered on a dark alley. And she had splints everywhere, and she was in just permanent agony. I just can't even begin to imagine what it must have been like. And she'd been like that for years. She wasn't meant to live. And I guess in a previous generation, she wouldn't have done. But she was one of those joyful people. I mean, it's the caricature, isn't it? She was full of joy. But she used to say, "Oh, Mark, I can't wait for my resurrection body." Well, that's when I first learned what that meant. I can't wait for my new body. But you see, she really got the nature of our redemption. That it's about being fully what we are meant to be in our materiality as well. So, you know, you're absolutely right. And our fallenness and the limits of who we are is just one of the things that we have to deal with in this life. And actually, I can't remember who said this to me first, but I think it's absolutely brilliant that a key to discipleship, a key to Christian maturity, is learning how to deal with your sin with the person that you are and all the limitations that you have, all the aspects of who you are. It's going to be different from anybody else. So maturity is about how you deal with who you are, with your sin and with your God. I think that's quite helpful. I don't have that horrible bone disease. I don't have to deal with that. I hope I don't. I hope that none of you have to. Any comments or thoughts? Do you want to come back to that, Debbie? Were you all right?
I suppose I was just thinking, because we're sinful post-fall, are we slightly less human than we're intended?
I think that's a really helpful question. Are we less human than we're created to be? And the answer has to be kind of yes and no. So we haven't lost the image, but we're not what we should be. And that, maybe you can put it like this, sin will always dehumanize. Just as any idol and ideology will always dehumanize. Because it's built on something other than the one in whom we find God's image. So it doesn't matter what ideology you look at, say, in the history of the 20th century. I mean, I talk about some of the big ideologies of the 20th century in A Wilderness of Mirrors, and show that actually, you know, the great irony of the Cold War is that capitalism and communism were mirror images of each other. They were both built on identical foundations of the Enlightenment, and their assumptions about what people were and how society worked were identical, even if their economic methodology was somewhat different. But if you think about it, communism in an extreme and capitalism in an extreme will treat human beings in the same way, as tools, as resources. There's no room for the individual in that, ironically. We talk about the capitalist West being, you know, home of individual freedom and stuff, but not on Wall Street, not in the City of London. And so it's interesting that the experience of the oppression of the state in the Cold War East is very similar to the oppression of the corporation in the Cold War West in its sort of end result. It treats people as statistics and units, not individuals, as units. And that's a very interesting thing, that you realize actually that has not gone away, has it? People, you know, when government policy, and I'm not talking about left or right here, it's nothing to do with political affiliation. This is the post-Enlightenment world we're in. People are treated as units, or in tens or millions, with a few noughts here and there. It's basically doing the same thing. It will always dehumanize. And so I think what we are saying is we have on offer the most incredible antidote. It's not just a kingdom that is about a person. It's us as we were meant to be, relating to that person directly. Absolutely astonishing. And being made to be what we should have been. Yeah, I think Tim's first, yeah. Tools, sort of tactics or points of contact apologetically. And you see, I'm flying to Turkey on Friday for 10 days. Turkey's on my sort of patch with Langham. I'm there twice a year. And I'm very conscious of some of these things because the Turkish church, actually, I'm going to turn this off just briefly. I think one of the questions is, what vision for humanity do you have? We were just chatting just now in the break, and I've talked also to one or two others, that how we find an argument, how we find a defense for what we think are fundamental Christian positions without using Christian jargon and Christian assumptions is phenomenally difficult. But if you are arguing against euthanasia in a parliamentary select committee or something, you've got to find ways of doing that. Some of you know John Wyatt, who's a good friend in London, and he has written some fascinating, and still is writing some great books on ends of beginnings and ends of life ethical issues, and he's done all kinds of things like this. One of the things that really struck me recently is that actually demonstrating and proving sin is a doddle. It's very easy. That's not a problem. There are very few optimists left, ironically. You know, it's politically incorrect and difficult to talk about sin, which is why I avoid the word at all costs, because I just don't like the word. It's not a useful word. People just think of tabloids. It's usually a sex scandal. That's what they think sin is. Very unhelpful. Where possible, I stopped using the word. But the fact that there is something wrong, whatever that is, you know, there's it's not the bad apple syndrome, it's the fact that there's something wrong with all of us, and there's something wrong with our world, and it's not just religion, and it's not just ideology, there's something wrong. I don't know anybody who would disagree with that. You know, I would think there was something wrong with the person who did. Have you not read a newspaper recently? And what happened in Paris and keeps on going on all over and stuff, you know, you say, well, what is this?
But then they do say it's religion.
But then you say, well, it's not just religion. Yes, it is religion, of course, but it's not just religion. It's the nothing buttery. And there are plenty of studies that show that actually a lot of these things are as political and geopolitical as they are religious, especially if you look at the rhetoric in the Middle East about America, the great Satan, you'll realize that it is on the surface about the Christian West, but it is just as much about who's taking the money proceeds from oil as it is about religion. But yes, it's involved. There's no point denying that. But here's the problem. How do we defend the original goodness of man? That is the difficulty. How do we defend that there is something valuable about a human being in our createdness? So we talk about original sin a lot, but I think as Christians, that is a problem unless you've talked about original goodness. And we need to talk about original goodness much more, because that will help us explain what we've lost in this thing that's gone wrong, whatever that is. And it'll help us to begin to have something to say to those people who say, hey, look, this world is getting a bit overpopulated, isn't it? 7 billion? 12 billion? 15 billion? Actually, we need to shave a couple of billion. People are talking like that. It's better for the environment to have selective abortion. That is being honestly taught in ethics lectures around the world. Peter Singer is notorious. He's an Australian who's a professor, I think, is he at Harvard? Or I can't remember where. He's certainly on the east coast of the States. He basically would say it is more important to protect certain endangered species than the lives of the unborn child. And you can kind of see his point. You know, what's another child in a world of 7 billion people? The difference is, what happens if that child is yours? And so on and so forth. So we will not get anywhere in terms of arguing on these ethical issues unless we begin to get our understanding of the original goodness clear. And we need to find it. I'm not saying I've got that sorted, but I think, don't you want to say to somebody who's just become a parent that there is something almost magical, almost mystical, almost mind-bogglingly boggling about, I remember holding my son aged 20 minutes, and I had no words. There has to be a God, you sort of think. It's just, there's something, and yet on a page of numbers, irrelevant. A couple of billion here, a couple of million there. But the individual and everyone. But then, of course, you have the problem of, well, does it matter if we lose a few thousand in the Mediterranean? I mean, you know, make life easier in Europe, wouldn't it? Really? With every death, you lose a library. So, I'm burbling. Tim, do you want to help me? Thanks a lot. Yes. And maybe one could develop that and say, well, look, how do you like being treated? For, you know, the golden rule and do as you will be done by and all that stuff, fine. But don't you feel that life is just a little bit better if someone treats you with a bit of respect? You want to be treated at least with respect. So why would that be? Why would they do that? And I think that's why, without being cringy and without being sort of heavy about it, I want to introduce people to Jesus, because It's just amazing when they see actually how he would treat them. I talked about deliberate self-harm yesterday. I was on the train coming here. I was just texting this person again. Do pray for her. She's having a horrible day today. So she texted me during the lunch break and said, pray. So I won't tell you anything more, but pray. But we were just chatting on Facebook on the train down, and it just suddenly struck me, because she cut herself a lot, still has quite a lot of scars on her wrists. So, you know, classic, we'll wear long pullovers, and even in summer, usual thing. And just thinking about the Lamb on the throne, and that he is there on the throne ruling with his scars visible. And there's a sense in which, you know, you've got to be slightly careful here, but there's a sense in which the cross was deliberate self-harm to save us. I'd never thought of that before, and it's slightly risky language. I'm not 100% comfortable with it, but you can see what we're getting at. He went there deliberately to love us, which means he can relate to her in a way that I couldn't. Amazing. And that's the depth, the extent to which he's prepared to go to love and show respect. Because one of the hardest things to deal with is not guilt, but shame. I can remember, it was very vivid for me. I had a sabbatical to do some work on the Wilderness book, and I'm fascinated by the Cold War, because particularly in the East, what the surveillance society, particularly say in East Germany, did to people, how it affected the psyche and social life, and what did, you know, absolutely ingrained distrust and betrayal does to people. It's absolutely terrifying. So I wanted to do some research on East Germany and the Stasi. So I was in Berlin, and it was a beautiful day, but it was snowing. But it was sort of crisp, cold. There was something, you know, almost Narnia-like and I was on the east side of Berlin, which still has the old trams. And I don't know what it was, but suddenly I was walking along, and suddenly for the first time, I realized I was overwhelmed with a sense of shame for being someone who has depression. I'd never realized it before, but it was always there. And I think looking at it, I realized that it was always there. But you see, guilt is about, I did this thing that was wrong, and I'm guilty because of it. Well, you can deal with that. Forgiveness is the answer. You can move on. That's easy. Shame is, I'm the kind of person that does that. Forgiveness is irrelevant. Well, so, I was forgiven, but I'm the kind of person that does that. And I was overwhelmed by this sense of shame. And then I started having to think more about actually the whole business of cleansing and being made right and being made presentable, and Jesus not being ashamed to call me his brother. And that made me love him more, because I thought, wow, I'm ashamed of me, but he isn't. Now, I don't know what your issue is. I'm pretty sure that you've all got issues. You're all screwed up. I know it. I've been in ministry for over 20 years. You're all screwed up. Just admit it. Stop being so bolshy about it. You're screwed up. Fine. Okay, now let's move on. But the thing is, Jesus can meet you there. And that is almost insanely attractive. Anyway, I'm getting carried away again. Sorted. Hi. The idea of
you're talking to somebody who's saying, this is your little bit to me. I'm just
Mm. Yeah, no. So a sense of moral or cultural superiority that... Yeah. So the entitlement and rights that come from earning them. Tim Keller has a brilliant illustration of this. It's at the end of his book, what is it, The Reason for God, Reason of God, Reason for God, and his lovely little book, The Prodigal God, which is a sort of expansion on the prodigal son. And he has the same conversation at the end of both books. And he talks about a woman who came up to him after a sermon, and he'd been banging the drum of grace week in, week out. Fantastic. You know, God loves us, and it's not about what we've done. All this sort of stuff, which, you know, for me now, that is just absolutely mind-blowing and wonderful. But this woman comes up to him and says, "This is terrifying." So he says, "Well, you know, expand on that. Why? And she said, "Well, you see, if it was a matter of me earning my way and doing what I can to get into God's good books or whatever it is, then," and it's interesting you use the word entitlement, she said, "I then become like a taxpayer with rights. I've paid my dues, now God, you deliver." She said that though, because the Christian message is about God giving us what we don't deserve, she said, "That is terrifying, because now there is nothing he cannot ask of me. Because he's given me everything. So there's nothing he could say, right, spend the rest of your life in an igloo in Greenland. And you would have to say, yes, Lord." I remember David Jackman talking about, you know how in America they have those huge signs outside with the name of the preacher and the sermon title, and David was saying that he had a sermon called Two Words You Cannot Say, and the meaning of that is the two words you cannot say are no, Lord. If he's Lord, you can't say no. But outside, it's, outside this church had this big sign saying Two Words You Cannot Say, David Jackman. but anyway, you can't say no to God after what he's done for us. He made us. He redeemed us. We are his. We're bought at a price. You can't say no. But then you have to come to the point of saying, well, okay, yeah, I am completely at his mercy and disposal. The most important question that comes from that then is to say, well, so what is he like? What is he like? Can I trust him to be good? Yeah. Stand on your own two feet, live your dream. Yeah. 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 Okay, I see what you're getting at. Yeah. Well, there's no one harder to reach than the happy pagan. In other words, the person for whom life has been pretty sweet and things have gone pretty much according to plan. However, you know as well as I do, because you live in the real world, it won't last. And so it might be that our job is to be there for them for when they collapse. And no amount of me trying to get it across to them is going to make it clear to them until they collapse and get to the end of themselves. And they realize that actually, I can't live my dream, and I'm not going to be Usain Bolt, and I'm not going to be able to, you know, be an Instagram star, and I'm only going to have 3.5 likes on my last picture. And it's, you know, just, hey. There was an amazing sort of reality star just in the last few weeks. This lass in Australia. Does anyone know her name? So basically, she's earned mint. Not mints. She hasn't earned polos. She's earned a mint from basically being a clothes horse and photographing herself wearing amazing clothes and bikinis and whatever else, and having lots of followers and all the rest. And basically, she's earned a lot of money, and she's what, only, well, now maybe she's 19 or 20. But basically, she got to the point, she was absolutely sick of it. And so then she decided to say, right, you see this photo, I'm going to tell you what was involved getting to the point where I could show my body off in this way. It took me 6 hours. I didn't eat anything all day. I was miserable. And that smile was the only smile I smiled that day. And she goes through all the most famous photos that had the most likes and says, actually, what was really happening was this, not what you see. And yet, my daughter will look at that, and you know, she follows all these vloggers and Instagram, and she's desperate. I was sitting on the train coming here this morning. There were a couple of schoolgirls opposite me banging on about how ghastly some other girl's Instagram photos were, because she's not that attractive, really. And why do all these people like her? And it was, I nearly wanted to punch their lights out. But I probably wouldn't have made it here if I had. And yet you're saying, this is a lie. And I think we have to trust and pray for the inevitable invasion of reality. And we as believers who know a reality beyond our reality must be there ready for them. I remember a friend at university, he was in the Oxford athletics team, so he was an Oxford Blue for athletics. Very, very, very good athlete. And was very close to the captain of the team, who was a brilliant sprinter. And I remember in a prayer meeting, there were a few of us praying for our friends, and he just prayed for this bloke, because he was your archetypal happy pagan. He was attractive. He had a beautiful girlfriend. He was very good at his degree. He got a double first. He was going places, you know, and he was captain of Oxford Athletics, and he was a sprinter. I mean, you don't get more glamorous than that. I know, because I was one. No, no. And I remember this friend praying for this team captain, because he said, you know, he's just like the feathers on a mallard. The water off a duck's back just slides straight off. He's just not interested. He's fine. He's happy. So he started praying that he'd break his leg. I thought, what? You can't do that. And he thought that he had biblical warrant because of the proverb that says, the Lord does not delight in the strength of a man's legs. Well, fair enough. but, you know, in a sense, if he did break his leg, that would be, you know, that's horrible. You don't want that kind of thing. But I think there was a reality behind that actually the charm of his life couldn't last, and the sooner he realized that, the better. I don't think he broke his leg. Yeah, well, the Lord, you know, was merciful and gracious, yes. Which is often the way, you know, compare the Lord with Christians, isn't it? Yeah, please do. Yes, and more. Welcome to the realm of Trinitarian theology. Yes. Now, Colossians makes it very clear. The fullness of God was in him. And he had to become fully human. Now, what we need to understand, in the early centuries of the church, what are they doing? They're not creating theology. They're trying to work out the limits of human language in describing reality. Reality for them had been presented through their experience of Jesus of Nazareth. And what you have in the Bible, Old and New Testaments, is that they provide, if you like, the boundaries for what our understanding of reality is. And the benchmark, therefore, to test every statement or assertion or theory or metaphor for the nature of God. So, it is absolutely true to say you will not find the Trinity, per se, in Scripture. And a classic, say, often Islamic apologetic, and certainly others as well, is that, you know, the Trinity is a sort of 4th century invention imposed on the Bible or Emperor Constantine or something like that. But that is fatally to misunderstand what the early church is trying to do. They're trying to say, look, we are presented with this sort of body of evidence and information, and we're trying to find ways to hold it together. In the same way with that, I'm not saying that is scriptural. I'm not saying that that is the only way or even the perfect way at all. I'm just saying, to my mind, I've tried to sort of put some of these pieces together like that. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, forget it. So Trinitarian theology is saying, right, let's start from the premise that there is something that the Bible is very clear from Deuteronomy all the way on. There is one God, the Shema. Hear, O Israel, there is one Lord, the only God, blah, 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 blah. And that gets reasserted in the New Testament at several points, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly. A very interesting study, I think I read, looking at some of the statements that Paul makes in Corinthians, so some of the earliest documents in the New Testament. Here is Paul, an ex-Pharisee, who would have recited the Shema ad infinitum. Absolutely, bottom line, there's one God. And yet what is amazing is that at various points in Corinthians, he will talk about God in Shema terms and yet mention Father, Son, and Spirit. So whatever's going on in Paul's head, and sometimes it's quite hard to work that out, as Peter helpfully encouraged us, he's not deviating from there being one God. And yet, this unity of God, this singletonness of God, is not simple. It's not one-dimensional. It's a complex unity, which sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? We've talked about that about human beings. And that you then have to start saying, well, there are three, well, what? Three elements? No, that doesn't quite work. Three states? No, that definitely doesn't work. Three persons. Well, possibly, and there are some who would accept that, some who would have difficulty with that kind of language, and so on. And you're dealing with some really difficult philosophical things. But what I'm saying is that those questions are pushing at the boundaries of what the Bible teaches about God. And sometimes they go over the boundary. Sometimes they get quite close, and the early church was trying to work out what was within, what was out. Sometimes if you went too far, then that became heresy. You realize, no, but that really doesn't do justice to the presentation of the Bible. Now, what can we say about Jesus? Well, he's fully God, he's fully human. It's not 50-50. It's 100% of both. Now you think, hang on, how does that work? Well, if you think in time and space, if you think of physical stuff, it doesn't make any sense. So we have to be talking about something else. And is he? Does what happens to the Trinity during those 3 hours on the cross? Does the Trinity suddenly become a binity? Well, no. And there's a sense in which, well, the Son in the Godhead carries on, but then his body dies, and oh gosh, we're getting on really dangerous ground here. But do you see, I think what we need to do is to say, right, let's stay as close to the safe ground within the boundaries and hold to those And then sometimes we need to go close to the edges and say, what is going on here? What is going on in those 3 hours on the cross or whatever? And we explore those, but let's retreat to the center as quickly as possible. So, you know, the classic definition that you get in the Apostles' Creed and other creeds of one God, three persons, and that the dynamic of the relationship in God is why he can be love, is the safest ground. And the best apologetic for the Trinity actually is Jesus, God being revealed as love. If he's not Trinity, he can't be love. Because that would suggest he needs something to love to be fully who he is. You know, how can you love if you are the only thing, person in existence? It implies you have to create a universe in order to have something to show your identity, to show your love. But he doesn't. He is imperfect, eternal, dynamic, self-giving love in between Father, Son, and Spirit. And then the amazing thing about the gospel is that we are swept up into that, but that's a whole other story. I haven't answered your question. That's because I can't. So we know, so Philippians 2, the word in Greek is, well, the noun kenosis, emptied. There's a lot written about that, much of which I think is actually deeply unhelpful. And the classic answer has been that he emptied himself of his divinity to become man. Well, that's absolute nonsense. That can't be right. And it's certainly nothing to do with the testimony of the Gospels or the rest of Paul, for starters. I think the NIV does a good job of saying he did not consider equality with God something to be grasped or exploited, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a slave. In other words, it's about status. It's about the descent in status and role rather than his essence. And the Philippians 2 song is all about love and sacrifice regardless of status. And you see Timothy and Epaphroditus in the second half of Philippians 2 as models of that. You see Paul doing it. And the reason for having all that Jesus stuff as well is because these two women in Philippians 4, Euodia and Syntyche, are arguing and have fallen out and they've split the church, and it's probably because of pride. So all of it, that stuff, is heading towards that issue of putting themselves first instead of the other first, which is why Paul writes, one of the reasons he writes that letter. So it's not about essence, it's about service and sacrifice and status. But there are definitely elements of who Jesus is that in some shape or form are constrained. So he doesn't know the times and dates of his return. That's only for the Father to know. Well, there's a mystery there. I can't get my head around that. He cannot be in two places at once. And yet, he can know what people are thinking. He can have mastery over creation. So the early chapters, say, of Mark's gospel are making very clear that Jesus is Yahweh. Not that Jesus is just a clever guy or a special man, but he is Yahweh. Who is this that the wind and seas obey him? Well, there's only one in the Bible, and that's Yahweh. Jesus is Yahweh. And you see that really clearly when you look at how Mark 1 brings in Isaiah 40. You know, the voice in the wilderness, who will prepare the way for the Lord, for Yahweh. And then John the Baptist looks up and says, oh, I know him, he's my cousin. Yahweh? What? Incredible. So there are constraints, but he is not less than God in any way, shape, or form, nor actually, and this is the extraordinary thing, in eternity, he is not less than human. He sort of brings humanness into the Godhead in eternity so that he is the Lamb upon the throne. How are we doing? But there's bamboozling, isn't it? Yeah. He keeps us on the safe ground rather than at the peripheral. I mean, I think, I don't know personally, I find it helpful to think of what the fathers were doing in the early church as they were arguing and debating about all this stuff, because it seems so arcane and vague and remote. But they're trying to find what is the safe ground on which we can plant our flag and plant our feet and say, yes, this is what I believe. And where have I gone too far if I say X or Y? That is helpful. And you're absolutely right. The cross of Christ, he certainly felt that that was his most important book. And it's certainly my favorite of the ones he wrote. I think we've had quite enough.
We're having two lectures on the person of Christ.